This is Ian Collinge, part 3 of 4, interviewed by Chris Eldenlee on the 30th of November 2015. Ian Collinge, part 3.
We were talking last night, Ian, about requisitioning, procuring equipment and facilities to go south. And I just wonder whether any company ever went bust on you or ever stopped operating on you, and you had to find a replacement in short notice.
Before I looked after provisions, there was a company called International Watts Fincham, and they had supplied the food.
Just give me the name again.
International Watts Fincham.
Watts Fincham, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Who were, I think, in London, North London somewhere, and they had provided the food for a long time, so I had a lot of experience in doing it. I think at the time they were owned by a much larger group. And very often at the end of the year, government finances work till April. So if you've got money left till April, you've got to spend it, which is a nuts system.
That's why I'm here now. It was last April.
It results in some unwise decisions in buying things. And I remember very well that the plan is my... It was Ricky, actually, that was looking after it then. He was going to forward buy the food, but of course we wouldn't physically have it. The company would have the money. And the parent organisation, which at that time was something like ICI, but a big conglomerate, decided to close the company almost overnight. That would have been just hugely embarrassing because they'd have had a very large sum of money and we would have nothing to show for it. In those days, things legally were much less tied up than they are now. Interestingly, the people who worked for International Watts Fincham ended up forming a small company, a two-man band, that did do, and I don't know that they still do, the sledging rations for bass. And the sledging rations are very specialised because the sourcing of things like tin butter and stuff isn't easy. And the packing of it is even more specialised to get a 20-person ration box in a box the size of a sledge box to fit on a sledge and work and last for a long time is a very careful choice of things and sourcing from a whole range of places, so it needs very particular attention.
So you instructed that two-man company to supply rations for 20 men in the field, and they chose what went into that box?
No. The when I dealt with field rations, we reviewed it, the contents regularly, and the contents changed. For example, in the days of dog sledging, there's a huge amount of butter. You get a huge amount of calories by putting a huge amount of butter in your sledge box, far more than would be in a reasonable diet in the UK. But it suits a healthy person working very hard. Sledging rations have to be long-lasting, obviously no liquids in them. They have to be able to be cooked in a relatively short time. You haven't got an unending supply of fuel. They've got to be robust so they don't fall apart on your sledge because it's bounced around quite a lot. So it is really quite specialised. In the days of dog sledging, it is said that the consumption was 5,000 calories a day. It was probably approaching that. The other problem with sledging is that you've got to get an awful lot of food down you in your evening meal, unless you're in a static camp. So the design of it is really quite important. And whilst I began to look at, look after the sledging rations, I got the Dunn Nutrition Centre in Cambridge.
Carry on.
To put it through a programme that looks at the nutritional content. And they said sugar and fat is sky high, but you've got a healthy population eating it for a short time to meet a need, a short-term need. So that's how the tale of provisions.
Where would the company that supplied you get those specialist items from? Or the, I mean, would they manufacture them themselves? Would they buy butter and put it in tins? Or how would they do it?
No, in those days, you could buy butter in tins, but you had to know where to buy it. The porridge, for example, was made for the export market. So there's the instructions on how to make porridge in about, I don't know, 15 languages or whatever, provided lots of interesting reading for somebody holed up in a tent. So they knew where to source these things. The main component was, in the original days of sledging boxes, meat bar, and that was just glued together meat and fat. It then became dehydrated, and we had to then often forward buy that because it was only made in a relatively small batch for a very specialist need. And we would latch on to where the MOD's rations were made and buy that component perhaps in advance. So we had to continually look at what was available because there was such a small market for it.
I'm amazed that it was available because you are effectively a purchaser of one. Nobody apart from Bass in Britain is going to be buying that kind of product. Are they? To take to the Antarctic?
The MOD are.
But they didn't have army bases that far south?
No, but they used it in ordinary rations.
Right.
So their compo rations were sort of that sort of thing, much too big and heavy for us, but components of it were useful. So the military was where we went shopping for that. That got increasingly difficult. But having said all of that...
Why did it get increasingly difficult?
Because the military were getting smaller, buying less. Companies were less interested in making for them. But having said all of that, the outdoor industry, supply for the outdoor industry, camping, walking, climbing, has got bigger and bigger and bigger. So there more has become available on the commercial market for that reason.
So is it easier now? Was it easier on the day you left than it was on the day you started?
No, it was still difficult. But I suspect, I mean, it's now several years ago. Mm. I suspect now you can buy the main component, meat or vegetable equivalent, from people who make for the outdoor trade, camping, walking.
So these days we're talking about naked bars, bar nines and Kendall mint cake, are we? Rather than meat bar.
There was always chocolate in there. The meat component was for your main meal. So you had an amazing variety of stew. So you would go sledging. You would have the standard 20-person day boxes. And from base, you would take the curry, the all the things to make it a different taste. Mm. But it would be a variety of stew.
Mm. I forget what they were called. Were they called meat bars?
The original ones were meat bars, and they were compressed bars, and then it became dehydrated. Mm. The quality of the dehydrated ones was definitely better. The chocolate originally was always, and I really don't know the reason for this, was dark chocolate, which is odd because it's got less calories, it's got less fat in it. So that changed as well. But we looked at it every year, and we also used to send a questionnaire south to people who were using these things to see what the response, you know, what would you like more of, what would you like less of, what worked, what didn't work. And we responded to that in latter years.
Mention the word meat bar to any FID and they'll just fall about laughing, won't they? I mean, I presume they were essential, but I'm just intrigued to know who you could possibly find who would manufacture such a strange concoction.
I think people like Bovril did.
Especially for you, or was it on general?
It was probably for the military. I'm not entirely certain. I do have some
old
files, but it was probably for the military at that time, and was hugely fatty.
In what other ways did the food you supplied South evolve in your time
in charge? Well, the sledging rations, as I say, the fat content declined, as I think as did the sugar. Because in the days of dog sledging, you would eat less initially in your trip, but as you did more miles, you would eat more. So by the end of the time, you might not be eating all the butter, but the end of the time, you would be eating all the butter. provisions for the bases developed because we tried to involve the cooks in a variety of things. The diet became more cosmopolitan, so rice and pasta appeared instead of just dried spud.
Well, the food's called foreign muck.
yes. And a taste, for example, tea, a whole variety of teas turned up. So you'd have your standard builders, but you would have what was then exotic teas as well. So the diet lagged behind, but did reflect the change in diet in the UK.
Powdered egg?
Yep. We certainly had powdered egg. We had dried vegetables. But there's a far greater frozen component because freezers were bigger on base. When I first went south, we had one chest freezer to last us for the winter.
In England or in?
In the base. At Sydney. We had one chest freezer to last us the winter. So we had frozen meat, possibly once a month, something of that sort, which we regarded as fresh meat. And if there's one thing that is a surprise when you get back on board ship or in the UK, is you do a lot more chewing because everything has already been processed because it was dried or tinned. So that was a big change. And when, as we did at Sydney, take seal, and penguin, or bird, we would eat it as well. I'm the world's worst cook, and I remember making elephant seal burgers, which reflected my cooking skills a lot. So you made use of what you took as well.
Were there ever any delicacies included to cheer people up?
What we used to do is to, actually on base, buy food, possibly from Stanley, sometimes from the UK, goodies, as a treat. I remember Faraday, for example, one year bought suckling pigs and made a mistake with the numbers, so they got, I don't know how many suckling pigs, but more than they wanted. But my view in supplying that was that if the base need to buy this, providing it's not outrageous, we're not going to be buying caviar, we should be responding to what the base would like to have to a reasonable degree. So for the base to go buy steak and stuff, I would have said wasn't appropriate. We should be buying that if we had the place to store it and could provide it, which we did.
I love all those lovely old stories about how the British fits would sledge across the Argentinian base because their beef was better than the British beef. That's before your time, I suspect.
Absolutely, and it's undoubtedly true.
But they'd also go across for the red wine, and I'm wondering whether you were also in charge of shipping alcohol south.
We did, and we there was always a stock then sent for entertaining on base, and there was a stock supplied for the ships for entertaining. But over the years, the amount that we supplied declined and declined until there was a policy at Halley to restrict alcohol, particularly in building programmes. And then we supplied the beer for that so that it could be dished out sensibly and there would be no binges. so that was a slight change at that time. The amount of alcohol that was supplied by Bass was always a relatively small amount. And at Sydney, we certainly didn't have a taste for gin, but gin was excellent for cleaning the windows.
Was it really? What a coincidence. if a company, you said you reviewed every few years, you tended to stick to the same companies for obvious reasons, but there would be a review. And if you did decide to go to another company, what kind of criteria would you want to employ before you to check out before you actually gave a contract to that company?
We would do a kind of statement of requirement for them visit them and talk to them about it. And let's take packing, for example. Mm. We would go out. We would want to employ, in many cases, companies that were local to us, to Cambridgeshire. So we would tend to look in East Anglia. So the last time we looked at packing companies, the packing company that we had employed was moving to other work. Packing companies that we used traditionally were companies that worked for the MOD. So the MOD had huge stocks of bits for tanks, bits for everything. They must have had enormous warehouses stashed all over the country with these things in. The fashion has changed to just in time now. So the company probably would store that for the MOD in their own premises, and it wouldn't be packaged. This was kind of all star. So that industry declined. Therefore, the choice of companies to do this packaging for us was less. So we would have to cast the net. And thinking of packing companies, we looked at probably half a dozen in detail in East Anglia before alighting on one that we thought could do it. This company, main role, they did MOD packaging, but that was a relatively small amount. I'm talking in the last 10 or 15 years. Their main job was packaging for the automotive industry. This company was in Northampton. The one that was chosen was in Northampton, although we looked at companies in Peterborough, in near Norwich, here in Cambridgeshire, before alighting on them. And then it was a steep learning curve for the company to deal with a variety of things. So they had to set up a specific operation within their company to look after Bass packaging, and that would only be for part of the year.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So they would have to take on somebody that could run it for them from about April, May time through to November, October, November time. And again, you know, that didn't fit with any company's
pattern of employment, yeah.
Pattern of employment or income because it was seasonal. They were an important part of the Bass operation and needed a great deal of supervision. So certainly when the packing contract was let to a new company of that sort, it would mean somebody going to see the company at least once a week and be constantly on the telephone to them. The packing company would deal with your suppliers if there was discrepancies. They would have to identify things, so we would ask people to identify things. Not all companies did, so they'd have to sit down and look at all the various bits and pieces that came in. And it was such a variety. That was something that we always emphasised to them, and I'm not sure that they really always took it on board until they experienced it.
Again, there's a theme emerging here that because the requirements of Antarctic fieldwork didn't evolve very much, whilst the rest of the world was changing completely. We talked about containerization of shipping becoming a problem because you couldn't handle the containers in the Antarctic.
Yep.
The same again, that the modernisation of the food industry must have been creating even more problems for your department because you had to stick. Your requirements hadn't changed that much.
No, they hadn't. I mean, and there was a virtue in that, in general, in that Bass were very conservative in change.
Mm.
And that was probably quite right, because if you change suddenly and things went awry for whatever reason, then you've got a big problem because of the remoteness, because of the cycle of resupply. You had to get it right for the autumn for it to get to the stations, and it had to work. There was no maybe it will work. It had to work.
Did you have a company that went bust on you and left you in the lurch?
I can't recall one. But that's not to say it didn't happen. But what happened was that you built up a relationship with many companies, and in my case, I built up relationships with clothing manufacturers, suppliers, manufacturers in terms of making anoraks and windproof trousers, manufacturers in terms of tents, sledges, very specialist, tiny, by company standards, our requirement was tiny. The pharmacists I got to know extremely well, and I had to know the medical supply as well, the medical supervision as well, so that all had to fit together. So you would get to know food companies, you would get to know them so that if anything was on the horizon, like, for example, the pharmacist retired, his father had actually supplied for Bass. It was a company called LE West, and they were shipping pharmacists, so they restocked ships. So they would go on board a ship in somewhere in the UK, look through the scales of what they should carry for whatever sort of ship it would be, and restock it and give them the bill. They're based in London. There's a chap called Len West, and he and Ricky built up a very strong relationship. Ricky then went on to look at shipping. I was passed the baton, and coincidentally, Len retired. So his son David took over the supply, and he ran the company. So he and I worked very, very closely together, and again got to know them extremely well. Still in touch with them. And he would assemble the various medical kits. Again, coincidentally, things changed. The medical contract moved from Aberdeen to Plymouth. Plymouth wanted to be part of the resupply of the stations, arguing that they could do it rather than just turn the whole lot over each year. Doctors are notoriously bad at counting things, which is a bit of a worry. Rather than turn over the whole supply as we did and make use of what we could afterwards, drugs go out of date just like food does, they would resupply sort of on demand. So this, their pharmacy was tasked with doing it. Coincidentally, that was when David was retiring. So there was a huge change there. There was a, because Plymouth then had the whole operation, it was integrated, but not easy because of the range of medical stuff that we used.
Because it was complicated, because your demands were very specialised and you were very much in the hands of your suppliers, were you ever taken advantage of?
I would hope not. But when I first took over what was then called Tools and Building, which is paints and tools and all that sort of stuff, I made a point of going to see the companies that were supplying whatever it was. So I went to see a company called C. Brewer in Reading. Is it Reading? Yes.
C as in water?
Yes. C as in capital C. because they had been used for a whole range of stuff, from sinks to plugs to taps to set of spanners to everything. So I thought, well, if I'm going to take this over, I need to know more about it. I mean, in each of the things that I took over, I had to learn an awful lot because it wasn't my trade. And the people who had been doing this were short on time. So when the base asked for a 4.5-inch plug, they just sent through for a 4.5-inch plug. And C. Brewer got to obtain these things. And it was an easy way of obtaining it rather than going down to the local hardware store, which we didn't have, in those days, have time to do. And I then discovered C. Brewer, when I visited them, were actually a painter and decorator suppliers. So plumbing was completely outside their experience and normal trade. But they had responded to the requests, and you know, built up really quite a big bit. And I thought, well, actually, we should be going to hardware suppliers, not to a paint supplier, that can deal with a whole range of things. So you would go to an export supplier and say, can you do this? Which, of course, they could more easily. That's not a criticism of what went before me, because they didn't have time to look for things. The amount that we were supplying was getting more. The bases were getting more complex. So I tried to discover the suppliers when I moved to a commodity, the suppliers that were used, and then look at them and make sure that they were appropriate, and you know, look to see that there might be other suppliers around that could do it.
Were you obliged to take the lowest tender?
No, in fact, the civil service term is best value for money. And for us, value for money would be confidence in supply, because if it's not supply, it's...
But when NERC took over, did that change? Were they obliged? Were you then obliged to take the lowest tender?
No, they would have applied the same set of rules. But, of course, when the SSC looked at things, they had no knowledge of sledges, tents, Antarctic clothing, ships, some knowledge of ships, but not in any depth.
Not many ships in Swindon.
No, but there are two research vessels based in Southampton, and I got to know them a little bit. They spend an awful lot of money on, for example, fuel, and I discovered that they probably didn't spend the money very well, and we had a better expertise in supporting ships. And, of course, that was part of the latter plan to move the Bath ships to Southampton and all be managed under one block. And that would have been... Ships are pivotal as far as logistic supply of the Antarctic. To lose control of them, you lose control of a very, very important part of your organisation. And that possibly isn't realised by many... of the science people within the organisation. Does it matter who runs the ships? Well, yes.
Were you still employed by Bass at that time when the takeover was being proposed?
Yes, what happened was that we had to assess the number of people that were involved in procurement. For us, it was not just procurement, it was also cargo shipping. They removed the larger proportion of people that did procurement within the section at Bass, which meant that, in theory anyway, if you wanted a tent, you'd ask your resident mountaineer to specify the tent and they would go and get one. Well, that doesn't actually work, because your resident mountaineer is in the Antarctic. And although you may well have people who know an awful lot about field travel in Bass, they're organising the field travel. They're not specifying the tent. It would work to a degree with ships. But in fact, we retained Steve Lucas, who... built up an expertise in contracts and has been running that site extremely efficiently, and probably since I left, is in terms of Bass procurement, is one of the unsung heroes, because he understands the priorities and the need for accuracy and specification and all this.
His name again was
Steve Lucas.
Lucas.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about medicine. You touched on supplying the medicines down south, but you were also, I think, involved in the creation of Curafid, the Bible of medicine for Antarctic explorers.
Yes.
Tell me about what happened there.
Well, when I took over the supply from Ricky, at the same time, absolutely great bloke called Alan Milne was the senior Bass medical man, doctor. Based in Aberdeen. Alan had been south, he'd wintered at Adelaide, and he had done a joint services expedition. He'd been in the Navy, a short-term commission, as a doctor on board nuclear submarines. And he came to join what was then the School of Offshore and Environmental Medicine. It kind of developed in both in its organisation and its title over the years. But it was within what was then called Robert Gordon's Institute for Technology
in Aberdeen.
And the organisation was masterminded by John Bremner and
Nelson Norman.
Have you done him?
I have.
Okay. So he brought together a group of people and secured the BAS contract. And it was the first time that BAS had a kind of cohesive medical support looking at medical selection or medical approval, looking at training, doctors specifically, young doctors, recruiting and training doctors, looking at the supply and looking at Curafid, which is the BAS medical manual, which was first published by John Brotherhood in 1970. Nelson's probably given you the background of all of that. But the latter, I think the second edition was produced by Chris Johnson, an ex-BAS doctor, with a lot of input from Ricky and a lot of input from Len West, but largely on his own. The next two editions I was involved in, for me, again, another steep learning curve. I'd never produced a book before, and if I had any role in Curafid, it was producing the book. So Alan wanted to relate the book to the training, to the supplies, medical supplies that were available, thinking really specifically of a field medical box, and the circumstance. So the third edition of Curafid was born. And this was in the early days of desktop publishing. We found somebody to design the book for. Well, I found somebody to design the book for us, but it was a hell of a steep learning curve in transferring it from one sort of software. I forget what it was, probably Word or something then. Into desktop publishing and then putting in all the pictures, producing the pictures at BAS. I've got vivid recollection of having ketchup stuffed up my nose, pretending to have a nosebleed. And it was cheap ketchup, so it was mainly vinegar, so it made my eyes water a lot. Putting cannulas in, all of that sort of stuff, CPR. We did all of that photography with BAS photographers. Produced the third edition of Curafid, which was that one.
It's a green cover.
Yep. Those are the first two editions.
This third one is 1988.
Yep.
And is it still a book or is it now a computer program somewhere?
It is. Well, I don't know is the answer to that. But it then went on to six editions.
Was that because of medical advances?
It was because of change. The Plymouth contract changed the support. For example, it was thought not a good idea to have controlled drugs routinely in field medical boxes. That was the fashion of the time. Things like, even simple things like CPR, changes from year to year. Oh, not quite year to year, but every time I did a first aid course. The book was also related to the medical course that all FIDs do in at Girton. A copy of this was in each field medical box as well. It was an integrated, part of an integrated medical support. And the foundation stone for all of that was laid by Alan Milne.
Ringworm of the Groin, page 227. It's pretty thorough, isn't it? I mean, it is almost, it looks to me like one of those kind of dummies guide to being well, the idiot's guide to medicine.
It's got to cover an awful lot.
It's enormous volume.
And just coincidentally, I caught ringworm in Stanley.
Well, page 227, Ian. I hope you looked it up.
So, thank heavens I had my book with me. For me, it was fascinating because I learned a lot from it. I learned a lot of the content and also how the thing was put together. With Alan, I would work really quite hard editing it with help of others. Alan was an absolute thorough gentleman, and we would come home here after a day at Bass, or even work here into the night. So whiskey helped an awful lot. It was, for me, it was maybe the first time that I had a sort of tangible product at the end of the day, which was this.
So you're proud of it?
Yes. But Alan should be more proud because it was far more his. I produced it. He brought it together.
And did you ever find yourself having to send medical materials south in a hurry?
It has happened, but not very often.
Can you think of an example?
Can't at the moment. There was... No, I can't think. I mean, no, I can't think of
it. All right. Was it always possible? Were you sometimes thwarted?
The only way of getting things... Well, getting things to Stanley was relatively easy because of the... Particularly of the RAF Airbridge flying twice a week. Once in Stanley, it really depended where you wanted to get it. Mm. Rothera was relatively easy since the advent of the Dash 7. Sydney was much more difficult. South Georgia was relatively easy because of South Georgia ships going there, as Falkland ships going there, and Halle it had to mesh with the sailing of whatever, either Bransfield or Shackleton.
But you did find yourself sending medicines or treatments south at short notice.
It could happen, yes.
Would that then change the nature of the next season's medical box?
No, not necessarily, because it would be the exception rather than the rule. So I've got there's a thing called the Heath test, which there was which was TB or something like that. I can't actually recall. But there was a suspected case, I think, on one of the ships. So a lot of Heath tests were sent south to either confirm or deny the presence of TB. And also, with the huge increase in communications, improvement in communications, gone were the days of originally of more CW and telex, and the advent, Bass was very much at the forefront of computer communications, so we were ahead of the game in all of that, and medicine particularly benefited hugely by that, and the advent of telemedicine. So your in a sense, GP would be on base, but he would have access to a specialist in the UK. And that developed enormously through that period.
It's interesting, because I won't be able to put my hand on it now, but there's one comment you made in one of your reports where you were surprised that Rothera was not in communication on a regular basis with some of the other bases around it. You were doing your inspection... 1 year, and one of the comments you made was that you were shocked, actually, I think you said very surprised, that the chaps at Rother were not actually in regular communication with people in the bases around them.
I can't remember the context at all of that.
I'll try and find it during the break.
No, I can't honestly recall that.
Let's talk about Stanley, because you mentioned what it was like when you first went there in the early 60s. That'd be the early 70s, wouldn't it?
71, yeah.
71. And the facilities at Stanley were kind of in... They were being reduced at that time. Ricky Chinn was in charge, I think, at that point. And what was happening to Stanley and the facilities available to you?
Stanley was... It was described by London as the forward base. And that's how it was regarded. But when things all moved together in Cambridge, it was apparent that because everything had come together, it was sensible to draw together a lot of the finance function, a lot of the clothing kit function could be specific to people and all done here more economically. A lot of the prefabrication was being then done by specialist companies in the UK, like Structapply, for example, that built Halley 4. And the first hut that they did was Damoy. So there was no need for prefabrication in Stanley. Things were getting bigger. The ships were still fueled in Stanley. At that time, it was pre-82, so there was no... Well, there was an airlink, but Aerolíneas did have an airlink, but it was quite small. It wasn't used to the degree that it was. That was from the Argentine mainland. So I did travel on that once or twice. But Stanley was still the sleepy Stanley that it always had been. And not a lot changed with Stanley until 82.
Mm. And the Argentinians turned everything upside down.
Changed it. And at that time, Bass Communications was still through Stanley. Mm. So suddenly, Bass lost communications with the bases. And it is said that things work far better that way. Stanley was very, very much a sleepy place. There was quite a number of staff there doing a whole range of tasks.
Who was there, do you remember?
The man in charge, the chap called Ted Clapp, who had wintered at Horseshoe, I think, on Faraday.
What was Ted's job? What was he doing?
I think the title then was Officer in Charge, which is a bit grand and very colonial. And with him, there was Clem Clements, and Clem was in the practical side. So a lot of the sourcing of materials for the repair, ongoing maintenance of the stations was done there. Field huts were built there. So he would look after that. Miriam...
Booth
was then I suppose head honcho in the office, and the office was then up at part of the Government House complex. There was an office down by the jetty. There was a store behind it and a workshop. So it was quite a Bass business then was relatively big, it fitted into the annual cycle of resupply.
You mean it was relatively big before 76?
Yes.
Before the rationalisation?
Yes. And then there was a huge rationalisation, and Bass was then reduced ultimately to Miriam.
Really?
Yeah. That took a year or two, but the old sort of traditional thing where you all trot along to Government House and have drinks with the governor and all that sort of stuff was in the decline. And the supply, the forward base, vanished really.
It was just a staging post.
It was very much a staging post. And Miriam had a busy job in doing what she did. And that, of course, multiplied when the Dash 7 started operating from Stanley as well. And we were flying more people in through the air bridge in Stanley. So there was the period of Bass business in Stanley till the mid-70s. Then moving a lot of the functions that were done in Stanley to Cambridge. Huge reduction in numbers of people employed. Then a period up till 82 with Miriam running the show. There was a throughput of people in Stanley in those days, but nothing like the quantity that there is today. The Upland Goose was still in operation, so that we would always stop there en route south.
And the pub.
The Upland Goose is the hotel, which is no more. It was operated by Falkland Island Company. Falkland Island Company is very much the Hudson's Bay Company of the Falklands. Had a huge influence in the islands, which after 82 was reduced quite a lot. Stopped in the Upland Goose en route south, and our arrival would have been timed with the ship's arrival, so we wouldn't necessarily be that long in the Falklands.
What was the relationship like between Bass and the Falkland Islanders prior to the Argentinian invasion in the halcyon days? Did they always get on, or were they sort of did the islanders regard Bass as a kind of a necessary evil?
The Bass pub was the Rose in Stanley, run by Velma Malcolm, who you probably tripped across.
I've heard of, yeah.
And George, her husband. Velma was very much mother hen to Fitz in Stanley. She was a formidable lady.
How do you mean?
She told it like it was, and you didn't dare swear in the bar or you'd get thrown out, and you wouldn't argue with Velma.
Was she big?
Sorry?
Was she big?
She was. And her husband, George, was diminutive, lovely Scotsman. And Fitz would be seen drinking tea and eating cake there a lot, and in the bar. Velma also supplied a lot of the beer to the stations as well. So each year there'd be quite a proportion of beer from the Rose be loaded onto Brunsfield and Biscoe to get to this to the bases.
We're talking about barrels, are we?
No, these were tins. In those days, that was way before the technology of barrels. Mm. And now it's done through the ship's bonds. But she had a healthy business going, supplying the bases. She was benevolent to Fitz, and she was rabidly anti-Argentine, so that when the Falklands were invaded, she was dispatched, and George was dispatched to Fox Bay, because they were troublemakers. She was a larger-than-life character that featured heavily in the Bass scene in those days. And what was the relation? Well, Bass employed a lot of people in the Falklands. In a sense, we were in those days an integral part of the islands. It was Fitz. It became Bass. So we were part of the fabric of the islands then. I think things have changed now. Stanley has got very much bigger. It's got very much more cosmopolitan. And Bass probably, when I was trying to bring things together post 82, bring things together for supply of ships and bases in the Falklands, I don't think there was a huge appreciation of what input Bass had to the economy of the islands. That was probably underrated by the locals. But Bass, post 82, was kind of lost in the great melee of...
Okay, let me come to that in a moment. We've got one or two more questions about the pre-82 period.
Yep.
But surely all these rather strange Fids were arriving on the Falklands, going to the town hall dances and chatting up the local girls and making a nuisance to themselves, weren't they? Wasn't there any resistance, any resentment?
I don't think so.
All these fit young men were passing through town.
There was fit young men in the marine detachment that was there as well. It was a feature of the Stanley calendar. So I don't think there was resentment there. Falkland Islanders then were very inward looking, because they were very isolated. The Bass boys would appear in their spring, but they'd seen it all before. It got bigger in time. Bass got bigger in time, but of course that coincided then with post 82 as well.
Well, let's talk about the aftermath of the invasion, when Thatcher beat the Argentinians and opened her purse strings. And what were the consequences then, from your point of view?
Well, Bath doubled in size. The focus was on the South Atlantic. So Bass were very much favoured. Dick Laws managed that, I think, extremely well, so that Nurk didn't take its slice. and that would have been perfectly possible. Don't know much of the detail of that period, but it was a big change. We suddenly had a huge increase in staff. We had a porter cab in the city parked outside the main building in Cambridge. We had a sort of, as an interim to the extension. I think the Duke of Edinburgh opened the original building and he was called back to open the extension. And I think he said at the time in his speech that he wasn't going to come back to open a third extension. We did have a third extension, but he didn't come back to reopen it. Bath was transformed during that period. Mm. It had gone from a time where looking to close Faraday, looking to close possibly Sydney, South Georgia was in question, all of those things. And suddenly there was a lot more money for research, a lot more money for ships.
And more money for Stanley? Was money invested in Stanley?
Miriam continued doing what she did. We ultimately were, in a sense, evicted from the old office that was at the head of the jetty, just by the Philomel store, because it wanted to be redeveloped by the government. I had to go and look at alternatives for the office then, it turned out that there was never any lease for this building. And had to kind of bluff our way through that, and eventually got temporary offices up and on top of the hill, and eventually took over and refurbished what was the Colony Club, which was one end of the Rose Hotel, and that functioned as the Bath office. And because far more people were transiting through, we had to have a place where we could store things, we could accommodate FIDs in transit, not accommodate in the sense of offices. Miriam then had an assistant as well, because she needed one. I had to look for accommodation. Accommodation was a very thorny issue.
You mean sleeping accommodation?
Yes.
Where did all these FIDs stay, both before 82 and after, when there were so many more of them?
Prior to 82, it was people got to know people like Velma at the Rose, who would stay possibly at the Rose, would stay with other people like John Smith at the museum. He had a B&B then, or he and his wife had a B&B then. So there was people dotted all over the place.
Homestays.
Yes, yeah. Because the only accommodation then was the Rose. Mm. The Upland Goose, which were run by FIC, and that was so for quite a long time. Then Fypass was built, which was the floating dock, which had accommodation in it.
What was it called?
Fypass. It was a set of letters. Falkland Island, forget port, and whatever.
Fypass.
Fypass. And it was a floating dock with offices and accommodation in it. We used that for a short time, which was substandard, but it was all that we could get, because then there was a lot of incomers to Stanley who were busy building up everything, rebuilding the place, and the place was developing. FIC then bought the accommodation camp that was built by the Canadians when the runway was built at Rotherham. That was re-erected in Stanley, and we used that for a while, but that was also substandard, really. At that time, the Upland Goose was also used, but it was the FIC, because hotels in the Falklands were very seasonal. Summer, Stanley is a very different place in the winter, and they could apparently not make money using the upland goose. So that was developed into flats and houses. So that went, which left Malvina. Malvina was then developed as a hotel. We never used it in my time, but it very, by Falkland standards, very expensive rooms. Accommodation was also very expensive in Stanley. So I developed a relationship with the FIC that looked at supply of accommodation, and that was Fypass, then the old camp that was taken from Rothera, parked behind what was then the Bass office, and then the Goose, and we had fixed rates, and we had I suppose budget accommodation because of the number of people that was passing through then.
You could block book, I suppose, couldn't you?
Yeah, and we would try and anticipate it. But in fact, we even ran out of accommodation then, where B&Bs did spring up from time to time, so people were accommodated elsewhere. We also had a contract with FIC that they would actually look for accommodation which would relieve the pressure on Miriam. And in those days, we were also running the Dash 7 into Rothera. So, and if there was a crew change on the ship, it was difficult to put that number of people up in Stanley. I presume it still is, but I don't know.
What happened to the airport? That must also have transformed. Is this Mount Pleasant?
No, the Dash 7 operated initially from Stanley Airport.
Right.
Dash 7 could easily use the runway in Stanley, and fuel was available there as well. And that worked extremely well until the Falkland Island Air Administration was part of dependent territories, and there was a lot more regulation in dependent territories operating airports like that, and that was kind of subcontracted to an organisation in the UK which was part, I think, part of the FAA, and for that reason my latter years, the Dash 7 then operated out of Mount Pleasant, which is an hour's drive from, as you know.
No, I don't. So tell me about Mount Pleasant.
It's an hour's drive from Stanley, so it's not exactly convenient. Military live pretty much a parallel existence with Stanley. We, at that time, also, post 82, developed a letter of agreement with the military in Stanley, which included refueling aircraft, refueling ships. We could buy MOD fuel more cheaply than from FIC. It wasn't FIC, it was Stanley, a company called Stanley Services, who had the fuel farm down at Fypass. So we could also, in some cases, have some accommodation in Mount Pleasant. So each year we would go down and review the letter of agreement and a memorandum of understanding, ultimately, with each of the senior military administrators. This worked variably, because with the military, the faces change every 6 months or every year. So you had to remake the connections every time. Therefore, it was hard work to keep abreast of that. And we took very much second place. They were not in a commercial business. They didn't have to be. We had to fit in with their plans. So we had to persuade them that, you know, that we needed fuel, we needed a berth for the ships. And we would try to give them advance notice of when the ships would come so they could program that in. And that took a lot of attention by... And the person in Stanley that was Miriam that became Pauline. Pauline Sackett. I think she's still there, but I'm not sure. She had to develop an on-the-ground relationship with those who were looking after tying up ships, fueling ships, all that sort of stuff. In the end, we also had some sort of party on board one of the ships each year to introduce Bass, because you would get a new commander of the Falkland Islands, and he'd say, well, who the hell is Bass?
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to develop a relationship with the military, and were reasonably successful in doing
that. Frustrating, though.
Very. Because you had to get to know to a degree the military mind, which is very different. And as I found in my time on Endurance, the same applies. Mm. You've got to work with it. You can't fight against it. So if you're happy working with it, that does pretty well, but you won't break it, that's for sure.
Let's pause for a moment.